We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short, and this is ACAM Learn.
Welcome to Mind the Kids. I'm Dr. Jane Gilmore, Honorary Consultant Clinical Psychologist and Child Developmental Programme Director at UCL.
I'm Omar Tassi, Professor of Psychology with a focus on child and adolescent mental health and special educational needs.
In each episode, we select a topic from the mental health literature and, in conversation with invited authors, sift through the data, dilemmas and debates to leave you with our takeaways for academics and practitioners. Today, we'll be talking about the relationship between parenting style and infant characteristics. This episode is called Parent Plus Child Factors. Does it add up?
So, parenting is a tough one for me because I think that as someone who is not a parent, I feel like I can come at it from a different perspective. And it's very easy to get into this parent blaming trap where you say, well, children's outcomes are dictated by parenting and the parents are solely responsible. But it also feels a bit disingenuous to then not put some emphasis on parenting because parenting is clearly important.
I like the way, Umar, you're raising the idea of addressing the parenting issue, because it's really, parenting has become a verb only very recently. You know, we've been doing it a long time, but we've now started to talk about parenting as a verb. And certainly in my clinical experience, there's now much more advice available to parents about best practice in the general population. So in previous times, the clinical population were quite well sort of addressed in terms of content. Now the general population are interested. So we've got parents actively looking for the science behind parenting advice. So the internet has democratized the availability of scientific data, as well as serving up a whole lot of the bad stuff too. So in my experience, parents are sourcing peer-reviewed papers or books aimed at professionals. And I think that's really interesting. I like the way you're taking that thoughtful approach. And, you know, of course, there's lots of very good professionals in this area who don't have children. But quite rightly, I think there's an increased value in lived experience in mental health. So maybe there's an equivalence in parenting.
I think one of the things that, I mean, maybe this is insensitive. I feel like it's very, let's not blame parents, which is great. Let's not. But then equally, when there's a positive outcome, then it's easier to ascribe that to good parenting. And that might also be kind of what we're going to be talking about today, whether some children are more susceptible to thriving in positive environments and then other children might be more susceptible to being disadvantaged in negative environments. But it's all interesting things in terms of where we place the role of parenting within the wider social context of development and children's development.
And I know you're very excited about the paper because we're discussing big data and you love big data. Can you just say very briefly why you are such a fan of these sorts of data?
I think it gives us the big picture at the population level. You know, we always have this, oh, the sample size isn't big enough. And actually, that isn't really an issue for lots of research. For some research, having a sample size of 10, 15, 20 people is actually a good thing. Like, you know, you don't need massive sample sizes for lots of areas of research. But if we're trying to understand what phenomena look like at the population level and what that looks like between populations, across different populations, then having these big data sets is really important. And also, you know, in areas like child development, children's mental health, there isn't one single cause of any sort of outcome for children. There are lots of different causes, and having such big data sets allows you to control for those different effects, include various different predictors of children's outcomes within the same statistical model. So then you can really pin down, well, how much of this effect is being explained by parenting or whatever other factor you're interested in. So that's why. And also, I just like numbers. I could all day in front of a data set and that will be the best day of the week.
Well, I've got a lot of questions for Robert, and one of them, which perhaps we won't waste valuable time on, but given there was 30,000 participants in the study, I want to know how big the initial spreadsheet was. Anyway, we'll tackle much more interesting questions with Robert in a moment.
Oh yeah, let's introduce Robert. So let's do it. Let's bring him in. Today we're joined by Dr. Robert Eves, who's a postdoctoral researcher at the Department of Psychology in Bielefeld University in Germany. Robert is the lead author of the paper, Interactions Between Infant Characteristics and Parenting Factors Rarely Replicate Across Cohorts and Developmental Domains, which was published in the JCPP. Welcome, Robert.
Thank you very much for having me.
And actually, I'm going to go back there and be like, can I call you Rob?
Of course you can. Yeah.
Let's do it. So what was your motivation for writing this paper?
So I think you briefly spoke about some of the ideas that are also important to me in the introduction. So generally, when we're interested in developmental psychology, we quite often use somewhat small sample sizes, but which most importantly are not nationally representative. So we don't have a good distribution relative to the actual population of the UK or Germany or whichever country that we're interested in. And this is probably quite problematic because it results in us not having that much confidence in our findings and whether they are true for everyone in the population. So I'd kind of read some of the past papers in this field, and I kept seeing, like, you know, a sample size that I thought could be improved upon. And because I had quite a lot of knowledge of big data, of these nationally representative samples, I thought to myself, well, I already have the data. I already know how to test these kind of things. Why don't I come along and try and show whether these effects are really happening at a population level?
Yeah, excellent. And I suppose my understanding of what this paper looks at is you've got parenting, so how a parent interacts with their child, the child characteristics, so the temperament of the child, for example, and how those two things work together to influence the child's outcomes. You've described various theoretical frameworks or theoretical explanations for why those two things, the ways in which those two things might interact to predict children's outcomes. And I think this is the real challenge, I think, on this podcast, which is how do you explain those four theoretical frameworks in language that's accessible? Because, and I've said this before, I have been trying to explain some of this stuff for about 4 or 5, 6, 7 years, how many ever years it's been I've been teaching. And every year I stand in front of the students with the same set of slides and I'm like, how can I explain this in a way that's accessible? So I'm going to lean on you and rely on you to try and answer that for me.
Okay, should we try and break it down? So let's start with a simpler, most basic idea of the world. Okay, so let's say that birth weight, so how much the baby weighs when they are born, is important for long-term developmental outcomes, right? So it might predict how many mental health problems they may have in the future. It might predict something like their IQ or their cognitive performance. And what we might expect is that as the birth weight increases, we might also expect the cognitive performance to increase at the same time. As you said, there are many things that influence things like cognitive performance. We might also think something like stimulating parenting is important. So how often you read to your child, how often you take them to a museum, for example. And if we looked at that measure, how much stimulating parenting a child receives, we might expect a similar pattern. So as you increase the stimulating parenting, you start to increase the cognitive performance of the child. The most basic idea here is that these effects are additive or independent of one another. So this means that as the birth weight increases, the IQ increases. As the stimulating parenting increases, the IQ increases, but they don't influence one another. Okay, so that's like the independent or additive effects kind of idea. What this specific paper is really, really interested in are interaction effects, and specifically different types of interaction effects. So feel free to interrupt me when I go on a bit of a tangent, but we'll try and describe these three different interaction effects in a way that's relatively easy to understand. So the first one is that the effect of parenting may differ depending on your birth weight. Okay, so for example, we might have an idea of vulnerability. And so let's say this was, in statistics language, we would call this a diathesis stress model or a gene environment interaction kind of model. And this is the idea that children who are born with a lower birth weight may be particularly sensitive to environments where there is not enough stimulating parenting, where there is limited stimulating parenting. And so if you take a child who is low birth weight and in an environment without stimulating parenting, we might expect them to perform disproportionately lower relative to the rest of the population. So this would be that those two factors in combination have a kind of synergy and kind of result in disproportionately poorer outcomes.
So it's greater than the sum of the parts, essentially.
Exactly. And this is a kind of slightly negative kind of concept or idea. So that's the traditional diathesis stress kind of model. There's then the flip side of that, sometimes called vantage sensitivity. And this is that some people have an infant characteristic which makes them more sensitive to good environments. Okay, so this would mean that in a bad environment, a child with a normal birth weight and a low birth weight, we might not expect them to differ at all. But as we make the environment have more and more stimulating parenting, we might expect the difference between normal birth weight and low birth weight children to start to increase and increase and increase. But what we would be expecting is that the normal birth weight children start to really benefit from the environment, where lower birth weight children may be less sensitive to the good effect of the environment, and so they're not improving at the same rate. And so this would mean that we would expect the biggest difference at the highest quality environment, with those normal birth weight participants performing really, really well, and the lower birth weight participants not performing as well.
So this is sort of, sorry, Rob, this is like the Matthew effect. So the rich get richer, right?
Yeah, so that would be an interesting kind of comparison. I'd never thought about it in those words, but I think that would certainly fit. And then finally, we have what we would call differential susceptibility. So this is another nice long statistical term, but what it really means, it's for better or for worse. And so it means that you are sensitive to good environments, but you're also sensitive to bad environments. So let's say that having a low birth weight makes you just generally more sensitive to the environment. And what this means is that when you're in an environment with limited stimulating parenting, you may perform disproportionately worse. You might have the worst performance in regards to the general population. But because you're sensitive to the environment, if you're put in a really good environment, it means that you can take full advantage of it and you can actually be the best performing in the environment when the environment is right. So this is suggesting that certain people can be more sensitive to their environment, and our three different interaction models suggest three different things. So diathesis stress is that you're sensitive only to the bad, vantage sensitivity, only sensitive to the good, and differential susceptibility, you're sensitive to everything.
That's very clear. I think one of the, if I hadn't read your paper and I hadn't read other similar papers, I would guess that differential susceptibility, so this idea that there are just people who are sensitive to positive environments and also the same people are probably sensitive to negative environments. And this idea that there are some people who are just more sensitive to the environments and there are other people who are less sensitive to the environments, that would be the one that I would say intuitively makes more sense to me. But as we'll find out when we go through the findings of the paper, that doesn't seem to be what the data is showing.
Have you ever heard of the idea of dandelions versus orchids? So this is another way that people sometimes talk about it. Orchids are beautiful flowers, but you need to put them in the right environment for them to grow fully. Where dandelions, you can put them anywhere, right? They're pretty much the same if they're growing on concrete or if they're growing in a botanical garden. And so essentially, we might have children who are sensitive to the environment, which we could call an orchid child, and they need to be put in the right conditions in order to flourish.
It's wonderful. Now, how would you, and obviously there's 30,000 participants, so you haven't individually given feedback, but how would you describe your findings to the parents who took part? Because, of course, some of those parents are vulnerable and some of those parents have had a background that might be difficult. So how would you describe those findings in a fairly brief and accessible way? And again, Rob, this is a difficult question.
Yeah, so one thing I would want to emphasize is that we're using observational data. We don't want to say that just because something is associated with better outcomes that we want to say it causes it. So I would just want to caveat or preface it with this kind of thing. But what I think we can quite confidently state is that the number of books you read to your child, how often you take them to museums, and how often you respond sensitively to their emotional needs, that's all strongly associated, or at least associated, with later development, both behavior, sort of internalizing problems or externalizing problems, and also cognitive development, things like fluid or crystallized IQ. And this appeared largely true for all types of infants. Okay, so it doesn't matter if your child is low birth weight or normal birth weight. It doesn't potentially matter if your child has a difficult infant temperament, so difficult to soothe. Or if they had a sort of slightly more easy temperament or a normal temperament, what it seemed to be was that parenting factors were just generally associated with later development, and it didn't depend on what the infant characteristic was.
It's a really good clear message and underlining some of the data that has been somewhat obscured, I think, by the different models and so on. And I think it's, you know, I think you described that brilliantly. And it's about heading towards what we know is helpful. Here's what we can do. We know this has an impact in later development. That's fantastic. Thank you, Rob.
In the paper, I think there's a part where you describe that some of these person-environment interactions might be different depending on the outcome that you're interested in. So, for example, it might be that in one situation where you're interested in a cognitive outcome like language or memory or whatever that might be, you have a particular interaction model or interaction effect that is explains the effects more. Do you just want to explain that a bit more to us?
Yeah, so let's go back to our idea of dandelions versus orchids. And we sort of talk about the orchid being beautiful, right? But this is just one outcome, which is like our visual look at it. And we might think that something like cognitive performance is important and we want to know about it. But there are lots of other domains that we might be interested in as well. So the mental health of the child as well. And if our idea is that certain children may be more sensitive to their environments than others, what we want to test is that true if we're interested only in cognition? Is it true if we're only interested in mental health? Or is it a general factor? And so when we're talking about a general factor, it means that they'll be sensitive to their environment generally, and it will influence lots of parts of their lives long term. And if something's more domain general, as a psychologist, I would generally find it a little bit more useful for the real world. Okay, so if it was only predictive of IQ, I'm not saying it's not helpful, but it would be really interesting if your something about you predicts how sensitive you are to the environment for lots of different outcomes.
Very helpful. So let's go back to this idea of big data. A single data set with like 5, 6, 7, 10,000 kids for this kind of question would be helpful and would be useful. But what you did was you took four large sets of data from different countries. Why is that important and necessary?
So my background generally is doing meta-analyses where you're interested in whether an effect is found in lots of different data sets. And then you're interested in where does it not work or where is it slightly different. So my background was more in how birth weight predicts cognitive performance generally. And what we did was we were interested in whether certain countries which have certain medical systems or education systems might be doing something different, which then might help children in a different way. So I had this kind of idea in my mind that, you know, parenting might influence developmental outcomes differently in different countries. So we had data from the United Kingdom, Ireland, Australia, and the United States. In some ways, these are all quite similar countries. They're all Western countries that speak English as their first language, or largely as their first language. But there are also cultural differences. So this would be adding extra evidence that what we're finding is really robust. And one thing that I would then want to emphasize is that if we're going to take data or results from one country and use it as evidence for how to change our education system or our neonatal system or whatever in another country, we need to first show that these effects are robust across countries. So that's the general aim, so that we give extra confidence, because if we'd only used data from the UK, some people might quite rightly say, well, the UK is a little bit different from other countries that I know. How do I have confidence that that effect is also true where I live?
And I really like the way, when I read your paper, that you look very carefully about exploring consistency across the data sets so that you could assume there was parity. The data set that you were pulling from was irrelevant. I looked very carefully at some of these infant characteristic questionnaires just to see, because there were slight differences in the position of presenting the ideas of fussiness or characteristics of the infant to the parents. But you explored that really carefully, and I think you were confident that there were equivalents across those data sets in terms of the different measures used, so that you could be confident that the whole data set could stand for a population.
This is a really good point, right? So this is potentially a slight limitation of using secondary data. So you can't change how questions were asked after they've already been asked 10 years ago. So I have to use the data that is already available, and all of the different studies might use slightly different scales or questionnaires about how they ask things. So as you said, all the four different studies that we used had slightly different measures of how they measured temperament, or how they determined whether a child was fussy or difficult relative to slightly more easy or kind of normal infant temperament, normal in a quote marks.
Typical, maybe. Typical.
Typical. Typical is a much better choice of word. Thank you. And so one thing I did was I looked at these individual items that were being asked, and I thought to myself, yes, I think there's quite a lot of overlap. They are generally being asked in very, very similar ways. I am happy to combine this data. So I feel like I'm comparing apples with pretty similar apples, right? I'm not saying they are exactly Granny Smiths or whatever, but I am pretty confident that the general fruit is the same in all of these different questionnaires.
And let's talk about your findings and the implications of your findings. So my understanding of what you're finding is that for the most part, it's the additive explanation that these two things operate independently in predicting the child's outcomes that's coming across as important across various different data sets and different models. And then to some extent, for some outcomes, it's the diathesis stress model and a sort of vantage point model. That for me, intuitively, I'm struggling to get my head around it, because it's suggesting that parenting operates independently of the child's characteristics. But actually, if you asked parents, they'd say, well, actually, I'm guessing, they'd say, well, actually, how I interact with my child depends on their characteristics too. So how do you put those two things together and make sense of them?
So I would say part of the rationale for the paper was that there were these past publications talking about moderation or interaction effects, saying that certain children are more sensitive to their environment than others. And that's the key thing that we wanted to test, right? We wanted to test for moderation. The idea that you're kind of discussing or talking about is a slightly more closer to what I would think of as mediation, right? So the infant characteristic influences the parenting behavior, which might then influence the developmental outcome. And I think that's a very interesting research question, which you could certainly investigate, but it wasn't the key hypothesis for this study. So what we were instead was interested in these moderation effects. I did have a quick look at some of the correlation tables from the paper again last night, and I did see that there is a small correlation between for example, the infant temperament, which is rated by the mother, and the sensitive parenting that the mother also reports. So this could be an indication that, you know, when you have a certain type of child, that might then influence the parenting a couple of years later. If we wanted to really investigate that, I'm not sure that these data sets would be the best way to do that. I would instead want to do something like a sibling study or a twin study, where you could then look at how, for example, twins can differ on their birth weight. So you could have a study where you look at whether the mum acts differently to her lower birth weight twin because she thinks that they are more vulnerable, potentially, as an idea. So that would be a really interesting future step, this kind of test of mediation, or how the child influences the parenting. And that's certainly backed up by like some of the most famous developmental psychologists of our time, right? So like Michael Rutter had theories that a certain type of child elicits certain types of parenting behaviors, and that would just need to be tested in a new study with different statistical models relative to this study.
That clarification is so valuable, because I think parents do describe day-to-day, and I know because I am one, but I also talk to parents day-to-day about the relationship. You know, relationships are two-way experiences. And of course, they can influence one another. But you're pulling apart the different findings from this study is not exploring relationship issues. This is exploring the impact of various environments on a child and their outcome.
Yeah, and of course, things aren't perfect with how you measure things like stimulating parenting and sensitive parenting, because something like how many books do you read to your child a week? In my mind, it would ideally be unidirectional. And what I mean is that the parent is the environment and they are influencing the child. But when we think about this in reality, if the child has no interest in reading a book and the child has many other hobbies, then it's not really unidirectional, it's bidirectional, right? It's that the number of books read is dependent on what the child wants to do. And so it might not be that the reading of the book is causal or the reason why their cognitive performance is higher. It could be other factors going on. So yeah, absolutely. When we're looking at the environment, it's quite hard to see a factor that's just unidirectional, where it only influences the child, but the child doesn't have any impact in the reverse direction.
And that reminds me of some work that I did a few years back where we looked at children with developmental language disorder, which is they have impairments in using expressive and oral language. And we found that children with developmental language disorder, when they were in their first 2 years of life, they had a poorer early home environment. And I remember when I was presenting those findings, I was like, this is not evidence to suggest that the poor early home environment is causing their language disorder. It's also dependent on the child, and it's very difficult to create an environment that's rich in language, communication, literacy, all of those things, if your child is not responding to it, because then there'll be a point where you stop or you reduce that kind of input. And I think that's the point that you're making here too.
Yeah.
The outcomes that you looked at, I think they're at the age of five. So that tells us that everything that we've been talking about today really relates to, well, we can be sure about it for the age of five or early childhood. Might those effects be different if you looked at kids in later in primary school or as they progress through adolescence into young adulthood?
Yeah, I think you're already reading my next grant application. But so generally, I think it's very interesting to, we're developmental psychologists, we're interested in the lifespan, and to assume that everything is solid or fixed at age five would probably be quite a big oversimplification, right? So I definitely would want to investigate these things longitudinally. One thing I would say is that one paper can't do everything. It can't test all of these models, different perspectives, different outcomes, and different time points, because at some point you're writing a book, not a manuscript anymore. In regards to how much do I think these things change over time, I think that potentially cognition is a relatively stable trait. So for example, if you look at the correlation between I think there was like a really nice study which was Scottish children who were measured at age 11 and then measured again at age 80. It's like one of the longest longitudinal studies in the world, and I think the correlation was surprisingly high, like 0.6 or something. Wow. Something like that. Don't quote me on that, we'll have to look it up. In regards to mental health, I think there's a lot more variation, right? We talk about adolescence as the key period of time where we start to see things like anxiety and depression really coming about. So potentially in this way, in this regard, in this paper, 5 years is a slightly too early measure. But the thing that I was really keen to focus on was that we did the same thing in the different data sets in order to test the robustness. So that's why we focused on age 5 years. It was because the different data sets all had similar data at that time point. So we had more confidence that we were comparing those apples with apples.
So I think you make a really good point there where, you know, there's, and I find it interesting to say it sometimes, where someone's like, well, why did you focus on this time point or this measure? And there's usually a good theoretical explanation, but also there's, well, that's the data that was available and that was consistent. So that's what we looked at. And I think it's nice that you've mentioned that, because you can't always have the data that you want and you can't have the time points that you want and you can't do everything. So you have to, yeah, like you say, you have to make it manageable and realistic within the scope of the project that you're doing.
But better to make a strong point at five than a slightly dubious one, you know, at 10 and 7. So I think that position is right. And Umar, I think you make a good point about the practicalities sometimes driving the hypothesis, but that's so important and useful for those that are thinking about developing a project to hear. You know, sometimes you have to be practical and think about what you can ask, and so that you can answer the question with some validity. I think I'm looking at the time, and I think we should probably let Rob go, because we've spent quite a lot of time exploring these ideas, but maybe we can ask him to come back with the next grant and hear what happens next.
Be my pleasure. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Rob. I think he explained some of those gene environment or person environment theoretical perspectives or positions very well. I was very impressed with that, because I was like, oh, this makes much more sense to me. I mean, it made reasonable amounts of sense to me anyway, but I now have new ways of trying to explain it to students.
And I think as academics, we do sometimes become a little bit tied by our language. And actually, if we're forced and required to unpack what we mean by a technical term, if you like, we are required to think in a different way. One of my PhD training tasks was to write a tabloid headline and a tabloid article about my PhD. And I remember one of the facilitators at the Wellcome Trust, sort of helping us do this sort of task. And one of the students said, my data is too complicated to write a tabloid headline. He's a bit sniffy. And the facilitator said, if you can't explain it, then you don't understand it. And I thought, that was really useful information to me. And I think what Rob described was how well he understands something, but it is, if you are required to put it in simple terms, it really does enrich the learning and the thinking. So it was brilliant, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think also it was nice, when I've tried to explain those person-environment interactions, I've done it with a different set of variables. Whereas Rob did it with his own set of variables that he's interested in. So hearing it from a different applied perspective, where you're talking about birth weight and temperament, is not something I would usually do. So I'm like, oh, this is really interesting. But I have a slight tangent that I think I just want to bring up here about the point of being able to communicate your research in a very accessible way, which I think Rob's done really well here. I was on the train yesterday, and as an academic who does research on child and adolescent mental health and development and education, like, one of the things that you want to do is impact policy and practice. And so who is sitting on the train, like, four rows down?
I don't know. The health secretary.
The education secretary.
No, shut up.
And I'm like, okay. I was like, is that who I think it is? And I'm like, yes, it is.
Lord.
So I Googled her, and I was like, yeah, that's definitely her. And then I found, this is sad. Like, then I found her Twitter, and I was like, yeah, that's definitely her. She's wearing the same clothes on her Twitter photo. She's been out voting or something. And I was like, okay. And then I text my boss going, is it appropriate to approach an MP on a train? Because, like, she is the correct person that I need to speak to about my work. And my boss was like, yeah, go for it. So after about half an hour of, like, psyching myself up, I was like, right, I'm going to go for it. And I went over and I talked to her about my research. But actually, after that interaction, I was like, this is why you always need, like, an elevator pitch of, this is the impact of my research. Because I was like, what do I need to say to her? What do I want to say to her? And I couldn't articulate it, but I did in the end. But what I also did was, I was like, do you listen to podcasts? I was like, excellent. Oh. She's like, yes. And I was like, excellent. We've just got a new podcast. And I was like, this is what it's called. And I showed her my phone, and she was like, okay, what's it called? So she might be listening, she might not be listening. But anyways, the point is, it's a good skill to have to be able to communicate your...
I love that, because, you know, actually, and I'm also, I like the fact that she listened and asked questions. I mean, that's great. I mean, you know, you're sort of on parade all the time, but I think that's wonderful. I think you've got to be able to have your headline or your punchline ready before you tell the joke every time you meet the education secretary. Oh, thank you, Umar. That's brilliant.
Should we talk about what we think are some of the implications for us, based on the conversation that we've just had with Rob and the paper? So I think for me, it's interesting because these theories of gene environment interaction or person environment interaction, there's lots of theoretical frameworks like we've described. And this is the second set example where it seems that the interaction theories aren't supported. So like, well, not supported as much as the separate additive ones. And there was some work that I did previously where we looked at polygenic scores, which are indices of genetic propensities and interactions with the environment. And we also didn't find an effect. And as part of the review process, the reviewer was like, this isn't that unusual. These indices of polygenic propensities tend not to predict stuff when they're in, well, they do predict stuff, but when it comes to an interaction effect, they don't seem to produce the results that you'd expect. So this lack of person-environment interaction, or the lower salience of it in this example, is more evidence that maybe we need to do this differently. Because, I mean, I think it's, I don't know, is it intuitive that people's characteristics interact with the environment, which is the way we're investigating, it seems not to be working.
It's so interesting because it does. I mean, these models that Rob explained earlier are fairly well established in the literature, and you know the interaction effects are too. But these data turned upside down some of the frameworks that have been pretty well established, which I think was so interesting. It really did make me think about this paper quite a lot. It really was on my mind for a few days after I read it, which is unusual, I think, in an academic paper. So it's interesting. It's really interesting. I mean, I thought about the clinical implications of this because I thought, well, on the basis of these strong data, these are sort of population-based data, if you like, how does our messaging change to families? I think the short answer is there is no change, because we know that warmth, consistency, sensitivity and predictability, the characteristics of best parenting practice, were shown in these data to have a positive effect on infants in their later outcome. So in some ways you could argue that, you know, parenting practice hasn't moved on much since the 70s and Baumrind's classic authoritative parenting, but we're much more aware of emotional literacy and understanding the nuance in communication and so on. The second thought in terms of clinical implications was the idea that, of course, there is no interactive effect here, but there is the fact that we have both, if we are both a vulnerable baby and we have less optimum parenting, we will have a poorer outcome. So of course we know that these additive factors often cluster in a family, so we're not talking about interaction, but the fact that, so for example, parents living in economic deprivation are more likely to have a low birth weight baby, and we know that socioeconomic deprivation predicts vulnerabilities in parenting approaches. Now of course there are complex environmental reasons for these patterns, but the point is that these additive vulnerabilities are likely to cluster in the same families. So the models that Rob was exploring are very important. And I guess, and also, it's not a but, and also the idea that these factors are likely to cluster means that we are dealing with the factors, in a clinical or day-to-day basis, in a very complicated way too.
I also thought the cross-cohort comparisons were really interesting, and I think he did raise the point of the cohorts that he's comparing, the countries that he was comparing were quite similar, but you know, nonetheless, in their different contexts, so they still need to be understood. And I didn't ask my usual question around what does this mean for other cultures that aren't white Northern European cultures, but actually it applies here too. I randomly came across this paper a few days ago where they compared. We always talk about mental health deteriorating amongst young people, and it's getting worse, the mental health crisis. And there was this paper where they compared mental health in adolescents or young people in the UK, I think, compared to Brazil, I think it was. Mm-hmm. And actually they found that in Brazil it wasn't getting worse and it was getting a bit better, I think, is what they found.
Oh, that's interesting, because I was looking at it across the globe, and there were some countries that had unique characteristics, but there was also quite a lot of consistent data. Now we're talking about it, and I can't remember the papers that described it, but cultures that were quite different, who'd also got increases in mental health distress as well as those that didn't. So what to make of that, I don't know. Maybe that's another podcast episode.
Yeah, I think it is. I think we'll have to do a podcast about cross-cultural differences mm-hmm. in the mental health crisis or not in some countries.
I think so. Shall we? We have been talking quite a long time. Shall we go to our takeaways? Come on.
Oh, so my takeaway is that when we're looking at the interactions between the person and the environment, there are a broad range of possibilities. And Rob described three, and there's the additive model as well. And actually, we should be considering all four possibilities probably at the same time so we can compare the effects. And usually, and I'm definitely guilty of this, I just look at one. I'm like, oh, I'll look at the diathesis stress model because that's the one I know about and that's what makes sense. But actually, there are four different variations at least here, and we should be looking at all of them and seeing which one is the best at explaining the outcome that we're interested in.
Brilliant. And I think from a clinical point of view, it's about clinicians engaging with both the group effects, so these population effects that we've discussing, and the individual differences. So these big data findings are crucial for policy and theory development. I hope the education secretary is listening to that. And also the well-established risk and protective factors that had the predicted impact on these infants at the age of five. So it's a reminder that these vulnerabilities need to be considered, on a case-by-case basis, and consider these treatment packages in that way too. Matt, our producer, has just reminded me that you can get a CPD certificate for listening to this podcast. And there are hundreds of hours of evidence-based child and adolescent health content on the ACAM Learn website. You'll find it on acamlearn.org.
Join us again next week. We'll be speaking to German Garcia Grande about the intergenerational impact of mothers and fathers on children's word reading development.